Hi everyone, this is Klaatu, and this is my show, The Bad Apples GNU Linux Augin Speaks Cast. And in this episode, we're going to talk about Bash. We're going to do some advanced noob tricks in Bash, or not really tricks, but lessons. And I say advanced noob because if you're already a Bash expert, trust me, I'm not going to have anything enlightening to say to you. But if you're someone basically exactly where I am in life, that is to say, you can get around Bash pretty darn well. You can write a few shell scripts to get some things done, but there are just some things that you're not quite used to or accustomed to doing or know how to do something, then this set of tips may help you out. So keep listening and you'll find out, I guess. So let's see, we're also going to talk about a new old website that I've found via a friend of mine. And we're also going to talk about listener feedback. I'm going to take some listener feedback because I haven't done that in a while. So let's get started.
I'm very good with this sort of stuff because I'm Chinese.
In anticipation of Ohio Linux Fest, like I mentioned last episode, I've been talking a little bit more than usual, I guess, to Sigflup, who is, of course, the Hacker Public Radio contributor, who does, like, Uber Elite Hacker Force. So it's a sort of mini-series within Hacker Public Radio. So we've been talking a little bit, and lately she has put up a site called uberelitehackerforce.deepgeek.us. So DeepGeek, who also is from Hacker Public Radio, gave her some web space on his server or whatever. And so that is, like I say, at uberelitehackerforce.deepgeek.us. So if you go there, you'll see all kinds of interesting projects that she's been working on, which are all quite interesting. Most recently, there is a sort of a terminal emulator, so it's basically like, you know, console or Xterm or RxVT, something like that, with a lot of interesting features, and I'm not too clear on what exactly those features are yet, because I don't think the project is quite finished. She let me try sort of a beta version of it, so I did try it out, and I got to see a lot of the cool features, so we'll see what happens with that. It's a pretty neat project, but that's neither here nor there, I guess. What I really wanted to do is highlight the fact, well, that the site exists, first of all, but also point you to the files section of this site. And the files, P-H-I-L-E-Z, so you know they're cool with a name like that. The files section are, I guess, random files, sort of in the tradition of like the old BBSs and stuff, where, from what I understand, you could log on and just grab lots of different files. So when I heard about it, and then when I first saw it, it kind of reminded me of that. It was kind of reminded me of like a Gopher site or a BBS place, or a free shell account, you know, where you can just kind of log in and poke around. And that is what I seem to gather this is all about. So if you go to that site, you'll find at least a couple of files. Some of them are interesting, some of them are way over my head, some of them are written by me, and so I think they're quite good. But you can definitely check that out. It's got some interesting stuff. Definitely see supermetroid.txt, the Metroid in a bikini post. It's very funny, but it's also really, really interesting. So just wanted to mention that, especially since, coincidentally, you can find the text file upon which this episode's tutorial is based. So on there is a text file called advancedbashbasics.txt. It was written by me, and it is what I'm going to be working off of to do the tutorial that you're about to hear right now. Okay, so Bash is a really nifty little program, of course. It's the terminal that most of us use on GNU Linux systems. I mean, mostly they go by default to Bash. And of course there are other terminals, C Shell and Corn Shell and all these other terminals, but Bash is the one that I think most of us use. I like it. I mean, I know that there's probably other ones out there that are better for certain purposes, but I think Bash seems to be pretty darn good for the things that I do with it. And lately I've been trying to do some more advanced things with it than I maybe have in the past. I'm no Bash expert, and whenever I do a tutorial on something that I don't really feel I'm an expert on, I always feel the need to kind of give a disclaimer. And the disclaimer would be simply that the problem with these kinds of tips, learning more about Bash and things like that, is that quite frequently you don't know where to start, because you may not even know what you want to do in order to focus in on what you need to learn. And cracking open a 900-page book that says it's the Bash book or the Bash manual or something seems a little bit unfocused sometimes. And while it would be great to work through that, a lot of us don't have the time, possibly the patience, to invest in that sort of thing. So this is a more pointed tutorial towards some very specific things that I've been doing lately. And the reason I'm doing it is because I can't find this kind of helpful information anywhere else. Just like I forget what tutorial it was quite a few episodes ago now that I was doing, and I remember ranting about how you go into an IRC channel and you ask for a question. For instance, how can I do, how can I change the file names of multiple files in Bash, but do it sort of a batch rename? And someone would chime in, and that's, by the way, not what this tutorial is on, but that would be an example. And so someone would chime in, some Unix guru, right? And they'll say something like, oh, it's simple, just use I for the variable in a for loop and modify that with a multiplexing do, and it'll be done in no time. And you're just like, okay, these answers are either so disconnected from the Unix noobishness that that a lot of people are, or they're just stated to prove that this Unix guru is truly a guru and speaks so far above you that you will never understand what they're saying. I'm not really sure which of those two things it is, but either way, it's not very helpful. And so I feel a distinct need to maybe contribute a little bit of information on this kind of stuff in a way that hopefully the normal Unix noob like you and me can understand. So let's see. First of all, you should probably learn Emacs. That would be my number one tip if someone said, how can I learn more about Bash? Pound for pound, for everyday use of something that you want to do in Bash, it can be sped up, it can be improved, it can be made more efficient if you know Emacs commands. And this transcends the Vi versus Emacs discussion. And I realize that there are ways to get Vim or Vi keyboard commands in your terminal and use those instead. And there's the Z shell, which is very famous for that. And that's great. That's fantastic. But that's not really what I'm talking about, because at least what I do lately, or actually what I've done for as long as I can remember, really, I'm always on someone else's computer. I'll go weeks and weeks and never touch anyone else's computer. But then I'll get a couple of freelance gigs, like consulting kinds of things right now. And even in the past, it would just be random, like, set up my printer for me or set up my network for me. I mean, and this is back way before I knew anything about Linux or Unix. I mean, I've been a go-to person for computers on whatever level I've been for quite some time, and I've used that as sort of income and stuff. So I would be always on someone else's computer. And now that I actually do know stuff about Unix, such as I do, I'll be on other people's computers doing Unixy kinds of things, whether it's Linux boxes or Mac OS X boxes. And the point is that I have lots of terminals open, right? And these terminals, again, by default, are usually a default Bash shell. So if you know Emacs and you can do that, then no matter what terminal you're in front of, I'll bet you anything it's going to pop up as Bash, and I'll bet you anything you can get a lot more done if you know the Emacs commands. And you might think, well, what kind of Emacs commands? How could they possibly help me in Bash? Well, a lot of stuff actually is directly transferable from Emacs to Bash. And one of the classic things is how to jump to the beginning of a line. You sit there and you do this long and drawn-out command, and how do you get to the beginning of the line to add something to the front? Or maybe you realize you're not ready to run that command yet, and you would like to save that command for later use. So you could jump back to the beginning of the line, hit Control-K, and then do whatever command you need to do first, and then Control-Y to yank that back from the buffer or wherever it goes, and paste the big long command, fancy command, back in, and then you're done. So little things like that actually just make things a lot easier sometimes. Another common problem is in SSH. If you're in SSH, depending on what terminal emulator you're using and stuff like that, but you might find that the backspace key does not work. You try to delete something, lo and behold, it doesn't send the backspace signal. Well, guess what would? Yeah, Control D. So all these little tips are really, really good to have, and the way to learn those things are to learn Emacs. And like I say, you just have to kind of transcend the Vi versus Emacs. Believe me, I use Vi in my everyday life all the time. Love it. I consider myself, at heart, a Vi person. However, I work in Emacs at my day job right now, and I also found that playing around in Emacs did two very important things. First of all, it taught me those commands that I could transfer over to Bash. And second of all, it enabled me to play Tetris no matter where I was. So those are really important, really good reasons to learn Emacs. All right, secondly, we should, because of the tutorial that is to come, I'm going to talk about variables in Bash. And you probably know about variables, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time. I think this is really basic information. If you're listening to this, you probably know how to set variables in Bash. But maybe you don't. So here's how to set a variable. It's pretty simple. Let's just use I, because that's what I've seen a lot of people use. So I equals hello. Just type that into a Bash prompt. I equals hello. And then if you do that, and then you type in echo dollar sign I, Bash will return the word hello because you told it to tell you what was contained in that variable, the letter I. So anytime you give Bash rather, a string and an equal sign, whatever follows that equal sign is going to be stored within that variable that preceded the equal sign. There are some exceptions, but generally speaking, that would be how it's done. And then to get that value back out of that variable, you do something and dollar sign variable. So dollar sign I says, don't give me, you know, don't reassign I or don't echo I. Give me the value that I've stored in I. And that's what the dollar sign tells Bash to do. This is a very handy trick to have under your belt because it's actually quite handy for, again, what we're going to do in this very tutorial later. But it's also, I mean, I use it for things like sometimes I'm doing manual things in Bash where I'm bringing, I don't know, copying files or doing something to another location frequently. And there are lots of ways to do this, and there's probably even an automated way to do this, and probably now that I know a little bit more about Bash, it will end up being automated for instance, a for loop. But what I would do back in the day is assign the location a variable. So I would say, okay, so assign I equal tilde slash archive slash storage, whatever. And then I can always send information over there to dollar sign I, and that way you don't have to sit there and type out tilde slash storage slash archive, or whatever I said it was. So variables can be really easy sort of one-time, or not one-time, but like one session-long little shortcuts to do things. So there you go. You can use variables that way, and I think you will find them handy. All right, so another interesting thing about Bash that I never quite used to understand, and now I do, and all it takes is a little bit of playing around, are the quotation, the way that quotes are treated in Bash. And by quotes, of course, I mean quotation marks, various kinds of quotation marks. So there are actually three different kinds of quotation marks. There's the double quote, which is the normal shift quote keyboard combination on the American U.S. Keyboard. So that's the key just to the left of the enter key with a shift held down. And that gives you the normal quotation mark that we use in everyday writing to denote that someone has said something. On the same key, but without the shift key held down, there is the single quote, or really it's an apostrophe, I guess, but I'm going to call it a single quote because that's more how it's used in Bash. So single quote gives you one little line on the screen. And then last but certainly not least, there is what is technically an accent mark. I don't remember if it's grave or acute or whatever, but it's right underneath the tilde key, or rather it's on the same key as the tilde, but it is not the tilde. So the tilde generally should be shift tilde. For some reason I'm not saying that right now. Tilde, tilde, tilde. The tilde key. Shift tilde would be that, and then just hitting that key once gives you a weird looking, it looks like a single quote, but it's really, really drastically rotated. So that's actually an accent mark, but we use it as a quote in Bash. They're all different. So let's do some little examples together. So first, so if we say I equals GNU, that's assigned what? GNU to I, correct? So if we want to get that back out from I, if we want to see the value, you would do what? Echo $i, right? Yes, of course. So we do that, and there's GNU, and it works. Great. So now let's try something a little bit different. So if we say echo accent mark $i, close accent mark, then it says GNU command not found. What happened? Well, what it did was it tried to do what that accent mark told it to do, which means to resolve any letters, any string between those two accent marks. Resolve that first, and then process the command. So what it did was, therefore, it saw the word echo, and then it saw the accent $i, and so it first processed the thing between the accent marks, so then the $i turned into what? GNU, right? So now we have echo accent mark GNU accent mark. So now it's going to process what's inside of those accent marks, and it tried to run, you know, just what, I mean, it tried to do what it would always do, right, which is GNU. You know, I mean, if it was a Bash prompt, then if you typed in the word GNU and hit return, that's what you would get, right? It would say GNU is a command that I do not know, so what are you talking about? Now, as you can imagine, that actually does come in handy sometimes, because sometimes you want something to be resolved before the rest of the command is carried out. So let's just thinking of a really simple example here. Let's say you've got a text file, and in that text file there is a host name, and you want to be able to ping the host in that text file. So the way that we would do this, well, we can do it right now. So first we need to create such a file. So if you do, if you go to a command line and just type in echo space double quote google.com double quote space redirect, that's the greater than symbol, host.txt. So now, whatever folder you were in has now a host.txt file, and in that host.txt file, like if you did a less on that or a cat on that host.txt, you would see the words google.com or the string google.com. So if we want to ping the thing inside of that host.txt, here's how we would do it. You would do, at a Bash prompt, you would do ping space accent mark cat space host.txt accent mark. So what do you think will happen? Well, if we do that, then of course the first thing to be processed is that stuff within the accent mark, and that is cat space host.txt. So it resolves that, which is google.com, and then it says, okay, ping google.com. And then it does that. It pings google.com, and sure enough, if you try that right now, you will see that it will start to ping, you know, whatever Google's IP address is, and it should return the pings, because Google does that. In that case, I mean, that's a really simple example, but I mean, I've done it in other cases where I need something to happen to some set of, you know, I need some conditions to be set up each time this command is going to be run, and if that's prone to being different each time that the command is run, or if it needs to refresh itself or something like that, then you can do it within the accent marks so that it solves that first and then carries out the rest of the command. And of course, the reason that works is because the accent mark has a valid command in it, right? When I first did that, like the very first time, I thought, well, how is ping accent $i accent different from ping accent cat space host.txt accent mark, and the reason would be because, of course, that's got that cat command in it, which is a valid command. So basically the end result of everything in those accent marks is a value. It is google.com. It's a string. Whereas if all you're doing is having a variable in it or something, or a word in accent marks, those accent marks basically at the end they turn into a Bash prompt. And if there's nothing there to do at a Bash prompt, then it's not going to work. But we've got cat, so Bash understands that. So it resolves cat host.txt, returns the value of that equation, let's say, and then it carries out the rest of the command. maybe a little bit confusing at first, but if you try it a couple of times, you'll get the feel for it. Okay, so onto a different kind of quote. This would be the single quote. This is the single quote on your keyboard, right next to the enter key on a US keyboard. It's no shift key or anything like that. It's just hitting that quote key. So that's the single quote, sometimes called an apostrophe, and I'm going to call it single quote. And this one is, I think of it as a force field, if you will. It is the sort of the polar opposite of the accent mark. It doesn't let Bash resolve anything. So if you're at a Bash prompt right now, just type in echo single quote $i single quote and hit return. And what does it do? Well, it returns literally $i. It doesn't resolve the $i variable that we've got that we created in Bash earlier. It simply gives you the literal string $i. So I guess force field or a literal tag if you do docbook, which lately I've been doing. So it literally says everything between this single quote and this single quote, that's exactly what I mean. So if you do something like echo single quote copy-r the internet's single quote, then it will again echo exactly that cp space dash r space v space internet's. And the reason and it doesn't do that, right? It doesn't actually copy the internets. You know, the internets are still the internets, and you don't have a local copy of them. It's literally the string. It doesn't execute anything. Or rather, it executes something, but the thing that was being executed is that echo. It's not like the accent marks where that becomes a Bash prompt to process information. It's simply a literal string. So you will notice that the Bash doesn't care that we said the space internets, right? I mean, if you had entered the command cp space dash r space the space internets into a Bash prompt, then it would give you an error because it doesn't know what the is, and it doesn't know what you want to do. You know, you apparently want to copy a directory called the and make into another directory called internets or something. You know, it doesn't know what you want to do. But with the single quotes, it doesn't care about the spaces. So sometimes what I'll do, being a Slackware and Fedora user, is I'll execute things as the root user. And the way to do that is su space dash c space and then the command. And since a lot of times the command that I'm executing isn't a single word, you know, it's usually a command and then some value after that or an option or something like that, then if you did su dash c, let's say, if config WLAN 0 up, for instance. Well, Bash just sees that as su-c ifconfig, and then there's that space, and it doesn't understand what else you want to do. So it'll just list the different interfaces or whatever it does, and then it probably, I don't really remember what it does because I usually don't do that, but it would tell you that it doesn't know what WLAN 0 is referring to, that command isn't found, something like that. So to encapsulate all that, you can do an su-c single quote ifconfig space WLAN 0 space up close single quote, and that will process the whole command within those single quotes without getting thrown off by the spaces and things like that. So that's just something good to know. The su-c would also work with double quotes, but I always do single quotes anyway. I forget why I got into the habit of doing that. Probably because it's fewer key presses. So anyway, the point being that single quotes maintain everything. It's literal. It's kind of a blob. It's kind of nice. The next quotation mark, of course, is the normal one that you and I use on an everyday basis when we're writing things or quoting people. That would be the double quote, and that is the shift quote key. And Bash sees this sort of as a hybrid. It sees it as a blob, but it will resolve variables within those double quotes. So it's an interesting comparison. Do an echo double quote cp space dash r space v space internets double quote, and you will see echoed the same thing, cp space dash r space v space internets. It doesn't care. It's not being thrown off by the spaces, not being thrown off by the fact that you just told, you know, that you wrote down something that looks startlingly like a Bash command. It echoes it back for you. But now do this, echo double quote cp space dash r space $i space internets double quote. What do you think will happen? Well, interestingly, what happens is that it returns cp space dash r space gnu space internets. I think it's a really cool one because you still get the literal feel of it, but you actually get your variables resolved, which is obviously, I mean, you can imagine the many, many times that would be very, very useful. It gets really wacky when you start embedding different kinds of quotes in other kinds of quotes. So you might have like double quotes, and within those double quotes you have the accent marks and things like that. So it can get pretty complex, and I think of it as an algebra problem, you know, I mean, and that's about as much math as I know. But in algebra, if I recall, last time I tried to tackle that, there's that order of, okay, this parenthesis comes first, and then this bracket, and this multiplication, and then this addition, and all these other things, that there's this order of things, and that's a lot like what this is. So you can embed and refer to things all over the place, and you just kind of have to keep track of what's going to happen first, and what's going to convert special symbols, and what's not going to convert them, and so on and so forth. So finally, the big, exciting, fourth, complex tip that I have is an introduction, and this, again, is a very noob-like introduction, because I'm still getting all of this down myself. But it's a little introduction for something that I think are called for loops, F-O-R, loops. And if they're not, I'm going to refer to them as a for loop. So you've got these loops that you can do. You can tell Bash to continue to do something over and over again until it's expended all the possible options within that loop. We'll go over that, and I think we'll incorporate some of the things that we've just discussed in it, which is why I discussed those things first. And then, you know, it'll be up to you and me individually to figure more of this stuff out. And the way that I'm going to be doing it is in a single command. So we're not going to drop into Emacs, to do like a shell script or anything like that. We're just going to actually construct this as a command. And obviously you could do it as a shell script as well. But I have been finding that sitting down and doing this as a command on the command line in real time, as it were, is kind of neat, because, you know, you have something you want to do, and then you do it, and it starts and it goes, you know. So it's a lot more powerful than saying, okay, I'm going to construct a shell script that I'm probably going to only use once, and then I'm going to go out and execute it, and that's that. You know, it's a different kind of feel. So I've been kind of digging doing all this stuff on the command line at the prompt right now, right then. So join me, won't you? So let's see. So we can do a loop. For instance, I had about 50 chapters of this book, and each of the chapter was an individual file. So I had 50 text files, and on the first line of every chapter was the chapter title. First line was the chapter title, and I wanted to construct a table of contents from the first line of each text file. As usual, there are probably a billion different ways to do this. The way that I chose to do it was with a little loop, and it worked out pretty well, actually. You probably don't have 50 text files on your computer that each conveniently have a chapter heading at the top of them. You could fake it by simply doing like an echo quote, Tale of Two Cities, end quote, redirect 01.txt. And then if you wanted to fill that up with more text, just for kicks, you could do a dmessage redirect to 01.txt. So then you'll have a text file with the word tale, the string Tale of Two Cities on the first line, and then your system logs, or on the kernel messages rather, on the in the rest of the text file. And if you do that like five times, you'll get a pretty good idea of how this works. Although use a different string maybe for that chapter title. So now that you've got five or more text files with some kind of recognizable, sensible string at the top and a bunch of geeky weirdness at the bottom, we could do this together, and it will sort of give you the results that we want. So the for loop, you kind of have to think this through, what we really want to achieve. So if there are five .txt files in a directory, right, that's what we would have, and they each have a different file name, but they all have one thing in common. They're all .txt files. So we could tell Bash with a little magical phrase, seems to just kind of be the standard syntax for a for loop, and I don't know all about these things, so I can't really tell you why it's like this. But what you can do is you say for I, and that's the letter I, in asterisk.txt. That little snippet of the phrase tells Bash that you want to grab onto a file that is not constant, but it will be consistently a .txt file. So for I in *.txt would result, if we were able to run that and then look at the results every time, Bash would first go to the, you know, the first .txt file that it sees, and it assigns the name of that .txt to I, and actually it assigns the whole file name, so it would be I equals 01.txt. And then if we were able to make it do this, it would, and I guess we could with like a for I in *.txt semicolon do echo $i semicolon done, something like that would probably get us kind of a very visual version of what I'm talking about. But the point is that Bash will look at each file that ends in .txt, and it will take that file name and assign it to I, and then it processed the rest of the command, whatever that was, and then it would do that again. It would go to the next text file and assign I that file name, so that would be 02.txt, and then it would do the rest of the command, and then it would go back to the 4 and figure out the next value for I. That's just what it does. I can't explain why. It's just like the function of a for loop. So we take that on faith, and it's a very handy little trick to know. So right now, of course, in our real life command, we don't have it doing anything. We simply have said for I in *.txt. Well, so Bash is going to look at the text file, it's going to assign I the value of that name, and that's it. So what we do after that is we put a semicolon, which in Bash land means continue on with the rest of the command now. Hold what you've got, but continue with the rest of the command. So, or rather, even complete what, you know, complete the phrase preceding the semicolon, and then continue. So we got a semicolon, and then you do a do. That's the next step in this little loop syntax. You do it. You assign the do function. So it's do, and then space whatever your command is. Now, in this case, what we really want to do is, well, maybe a little bit complex, but I mean, think about what we're trying to do. We're trying to take that first line of all these text files, one at a time, and we want to put it into a table of contents. Well, how would you do that if you just had one text file? That's how you kind of have to think about it. Well, what I would do is I would do a head on the text file, but I would not, you know, head by default takes what, the first 10 lines of a text file and spits it back out to you. There is a switch in head and tail, dash in, which I think means like number. And that says, well, override the default number of 10 and do this number instead. So dash in 1 would say, do what normally head does, but then only give me one line back. That would give you that first line. And then, of course, you would want to redirect that into some kind of file, maybe called chapters.list, let's say. So the complete command, the complete do command, would be do echo space accent mark head dash in 1 space $i accent mark redirect chapters dot list. Why are we doing it that way? Well, because we need to tell Bash that we want to move the value of whatever this head dash in 1 command is going to be. We want to take that value and we want to then echo it into the chapters dot list. And of course, the way that we can do that is with these accent marks, because we know that it will first resolve the accent mark phrase and then process the rest of that command. So by echoing the results of accent head dash in 1 $i accent mark and then redirecting it, you know, appending it into chapters.list means that for each file it sees and calls I, it's going to then echo the value of head dash in 1 into chapters.list. And again, there's probably a different way to do that, and fancier other ways, and shorter ways, and all that other stuff. But this is the one that was working for me. It's the one that I came up with, and so that's what I'm saying here. After I'd done that, I figured probably I didn't need to echo anything, because you could always just redirect the output of head directly to chapters.list. But I didn't really think of that until after I'd figured all this stuff out and ran the command and got my chapter list done. And I still think that knowing the little accent mark trick is a handy thing to know and understand why it's doing that stuff first and then echoing it into chapters.list. That's just handy because in more complex commands, you'll end up doing that more so than just saying, okay, now run head and echo and redirect that into chapters. A lot of times it will require a few more levels of solving stuff first. So getting used to that is not a bad idea. So how do we get bash to continue to the next portion of the phrase, or the command rather? It's a semicolon. So our command right now would stand as being for I in *.txt semicolon do echo accent mark head dash in one $i accent mark redirect chapters dot list semicolon. So really the only thing left to do for this pretty simple thing is to put the word done. The cool thing about bash, and the thing that used to kind of confuse me until I just kind of accepted it on faith, was that bash is smart enough to know that once it runs out of .txt files, then it's really, really done. I could never figure out how for I in *.txt was telling it to do something for, you know, each .txt file in this directory and then just magically stop. I didn't understand why it didn't return back to, you know, 01 and just keep going and going and going. And I believe the answer is that bash is simply smart enough to know that it passes through each file once, and then it marks that off as kind of done in its little bash head, and then it knows not to wrap itself back around. And I believe that's just a function of bash. That's what it does. And that's about it for the bash tutorial, to be honest. Hopefully the tips have helped. I don't pretend like this is a complete introduction to bash or advanced tutorial or anything like that, but like I said, if you're exactly where I am in your bash life, then this might really be great for you. It certainly has opened up a whole new world of bash use for me, and I always used to wonder, you know, how people would rattle off commands like that. You know, I always wonder what that I in whatever, and then it shows back up $i. I was just like, well, how do you ever define that? Where does that get it defined? It was very confusing, but hopefully this has helped. And if you play around with these kinds of commands in a safe environment, then you should start to get a feel for it. As Ken Fallon, I had Ken Fallon kind of review this because I thought he was a bash genius, and he says he's not, so whatever. But I had him review this, and he pointed out for me that some of my examples in the first iteration of this tutorial had rm-r in it, and it was, you know, very safe. It was like rm-rf, the internets. Haha, very funny. You can't remove the internets. But he pointed out that having that in an example, rm-rf, is just kind of like asking for trouble. So I do want to emphasize that if you're going to be messing around with this kind of stuff, you want to do it in a safe environment. You don't want to do it on files that you actually care about. You know, believe me, I've done that before, where somehow I end up moving all the files into one thing or overwriting them all, you know, just horrible things like that. So if you're just getting your feet wet with this, you probably want to try this on some sample files just to get your statement written, and then you confirm that it works, and then you take that statement over to your live environment or to the directory that you're actually interested in doing things in, and do it there. That's just best practices. Otherwise, have fun. Bash is really, really cool. I'm really starting to appreciate some of the more subtle, powerful things that it can do. And, yeah, knock yourself out and let me know how it goes. And if you learn anything cool, let me know. Thanks. Yes, that's right. It is time for a cup of coffee. So go get yourself a cup of coffee, and then come back and we'll do some listener feedback, and I promise it will be very, very interesting. See you soon. Alright, so first email, actually not the first, the most recent, I'm kind of going backwards, that's okay. So first email is from Ron, friend Ron, who emails me a lot of really just bizarrely interesting stuff. I mean, just stuff that sometimes I look at it and I'm like, this doesn't look interesting. I don't want to click on this link. It looks boring. And I click on it and it's something really, really interesting. So anyway, he emailed me recently about the Celeste Lynn Paul interview that I did for HPR. Now, Celeste Lynn Paul is someone who I'd heard on a couple of different shows. I think she was probably on, like, Lug Radio. I think she was on, well, I know she was on a series of KDE interviews from some events. I want to say it was it wasn't Tokamak, it was like, it was that Academy, of course, it was Academy. Erin Saigo actually was interviewing her, and they were both really tired or something. It was a funny interview. Anyway, I've heard of her for a very long time, because she's kind of the usability person in the KDE world, and I've always been interested in interface design and usability, or not always, but I am interested in user interface design and accessibility and all these different kinds of concepts, like how we interface with computers and stuff like that, and what's intuitive, what's not, etc. So I was really kind of interested in speaking to her at some point, and she ended up going to SELF, Southeast Linux Fest, and I was really nervous, but luckily a friend of mine there, who was also at SELF, Mako, from the Kubuntu project, we were kind of just chatting, and I think she mentioned Celeste Lynn Paul or something, and I asked her to introduce me, and so she did, and I really, really nervously asked for an interview, and I think possibly Celeste Lynn Paul was a little bit, like, hesitant, because I think probably she probably gets interviewed a lot, and not necessarily by people who know anything about KDE, but she was a good sport, and she gave me the interview, and we talked, and I just couldn't stop talking to her. I mean, it was such an interesting conversation. I literally could have talked to her for another hour and a half. I think the interview is really good. So if you haven't heard it, go check it out. It's on Hacker Public Radio. Caveat, at the time that I'm recording this, it's a broken episode. It is only 1.6 megabytes and lasts for about 4 minutes. That is not correct. Something must have happened with the upload or the process of getting the episode from the Hacker Public Radio inbox to the Hacker Public Radio database that they use to actually post episodes. Somewhere in there, something got cut off, and so it's only 1.6 megabytes, 4 minutes. The actual interview is like 30 minutes. If you cannot get the MP3 link, I have posted the AUG link, which for some reason isn't in the notes, the show notes, so I posted that in the comment field. If you click on my name in the comment, it'll take you right to it, or otherwise just use the link that I paste in there. And it's basically just the badapples.info/audiophile/ what would it be? HPR_Celeste Lynn Paul, where the L and the P are capital, .aug, and that will get you the whole episode. And you should be listening to it in AUG anyway, so quit your complaining. Let's see, what else? Something from Ken about an upcoming episode of his, but I don't think that was really for public consumption, but get ready for a really interesting Hacker Public Radio episode from Ken as well. That'll be good. Now, someone who has been... he's emailed me before, I think. I know he has emailed me before. I think it was just during this season that he emailed me last. But anyway, his name is Doru, and I think he might have been the one, or maybe not, I don't know, this person, this very respectable human being, says that he was a little bit involved with the porting of Rockbox to the version 1 of the Sansa Fuse, which is the stable version that people can use right now and get all the fullest features that you could ever want out of it. He said that he wasn't hardcore, you know, he wasn't like the coder on the project or anything like that, but he does cite reverse engineering, which, I mean, I don't know about you, but that sounds pretty cool to me. So, anyway, what Doru says is that the original firmware is in no way obliterated when you install Rockbox, and that does seem to be true. That's what I've always heard about Rockbox, actually. You can always boot into the alternate firmware by holding the left key down while pressing the power. So that's something that I actually did not know. And of course, as a couple of people have pointed out to me, Broham in IRC, Doru now, I think a couple of other people too, the USB support doesn't actually exist in Rockbox for the version 2 right now. And that is why when you plug it into the computer, the screen shows like all the original firmware-y kind of stuff, like the little Rockbox logo, which looks bizarrely like a Windows logo to me. So I don't really understand, like, why do these companies, like, and Google Chrome, their logo is, like, weirdly Windows-esque, too. You know, it's got that multicolor thing going on. I don't really understand why these tech companies all think that the penultimate logo is some shape, vaguely circular, vaguely square, with those four primary colors in each quadrant. I don't know what that's all about. But anyway, I mean, maybe if Linux, like, you know, dropped the penguin and went with, like, a box with four colors in it that would, like, propel it into popularity. So yes, that's USB. The Make AMS Boot, MK AMS Boot thing, supports the older firmware revisions for the release version. The development version has a couple of different things that it will support. It looks like there's a lot of flexibility as to which firmware you use. I was simply probably using the wrong MK AMS Boot executable or something like that to get mine done, but it sounds like it's a lot more flexible than I realized. So that was good to know as well. He points out that the recording quality, because I mentioned, I think, that I haven't even tried out recording on it or anything, is basically simply affected by the tiny microphone, which, of course, obviously makes sense. That's common, or I think it's common knowledge. I mean, when you have a microphone on one of these small portable devices, the microphone itself is just like this little pinpoint, and you're not going to get the same kind of quality from that sort of microphone as you are a big professional microphone that you bought and that's got a nice big diaphragm in it to catch all the subtleties of all the sound waves that are hitting it. So, yes, I agree with this, but the software side of it sounds like it can handle whatever you need it to handle, and that would make sense to me. The photo viewing is okay, he says. Actually, I've tried photo viewing since the last... since that last show, episode 14, where I was talking about Rockbox and stuff, it looks great to me, not just okay. So I don't. Oh, he says quite okay. So I guess that's sort of like saying great. He says that video isn't all that good, and this is an interesting point of contention because he says that the MPEG Player plugin is available, but it only supports MPEG 1 and 2 video, and not the more complex things like XVID. Now that honestly is two formats that I count: MPEG 1 and MPEG 2. Which, frankly, is a lot better than the default SANSA thing that they do. And here's something that SANSA does. They require you to encode videos, well, really using, like, their little Windows-based video encoder. But it turns out someone figured out how to do all this stuff and wrote a Linux client for it called Video 4 Fuse, which I heard about on the Linux Link Tech Show. Actually, Dan mentioned it. So Video 4 Fuse takes your video, and it applies some special magical codec or codec supplement to it called FuseMux. And FuseMux is something that takes, I know nothing of the code behind it, but it looks as if though it takes the different streams that you've got going on in your video and, well, muxes it in a very, very specific and special way. There's no way around this, as it turns out. I'm pretty handy with FFmpeg, and I sat down with this, I looked up online all the technical specifications, got the specs of what kind of video the Fuse requires, and I emulated it exactly, down to the last bit rate, down to the frame rate, down to everything was exactly what they wanted, and yet it could not play it until I finally found the requirement that it has to have been made with this thing called FuseMux. And if it's not muxed that particular way, if the data isn't split in this very specific way, then it will not play on your SANSA Fuse with your original firmware. So Rockbox supporting MPEG 1 and MPEG 2 and not requiring you to bend over backwards and find this FuseMux thing and do this thing with all the Video 4 Fuse application and stuff that you don't necessarily even want to be messing with is a huge bonus. So video, quote, isn't all that good, unquote. I want to see proof of that fact because it's sounding pretty good to me, and I still haven't tried it, so I will try it eventually. He gives some notes about sort of the internals of the SANSA Fuse. There's something called VXWorks, and it's some kind of embedded operating system made by some third party somewhere, and that is apparently what SANSA bases their firmware on. And he points out that it's not necessarily, they might not be able to be open with that because they're not, that's not part of their deal. And they might not be able to say, okay, Rockbox is going to be our official firmware, simply because there's a lot of codec support and stuff like that, I guess, in Rockbox that isn't necessarily, legal to the point of being able to be championed by some legal entity like a corporation or a company or in, whatever SANSA is. Now, this is kind of a trite answer, I think. It's one of those things where it's just kind of like, oh, SANSA can't do this because it's just too complex, there's too many legal issues, whatever. I just I'm not the type of person to buy that kind of excuse from fans. So I'm not saying I'm not saying Doru shouldn't have ever said this. I'm saying that if this is the reason that Sansa cannot or will not support Rockbox as their official firmware, I don't know. I tend to think that big corporations that manage to make all these electronic devices and pollute all the oceans and make all this lethal plastic that we're putting into landfills and all these other wonderful things that companies manage to do, and yet they can't manage to make legal support for MP3 and AUG and FLAC and M4A and all these other things. I don't know. I don't buy it. It's basically like we're all letting these legal tenets kind of get into the way of true progress, and yet we find our way around all kinds of other things that actually affect something, that actually do damage, or in some cases would do good. So, I don't know. I'm not buying it. I think Sansa could try harder. People are paying for these devices, and if they are serious about wanting to, like, knock iPod out of the sky as the big reigning media player, I don't know. I they would do it. Rockbox absolutely rocks. Another good point Doru makes is that Rockbox is not necessarily the most user-friendly interface. I kind of disagree with him again on that one, because I find Rockbox supremely more logical than, for instance, the iPod or even the original Sansa navigation methods. I get what he's saying, though. It does have little quirks, and it's got a lot of options, and people tend to get lost in a lot of options, but I'm still going to say that it's no worse, at least, than any of the other ones, because I've watched friends who are good enough with electronics get completely lost in their iPod and have to bail out, you know, just keep pressing the up button or whatever, you know, they get completely lost in that thing. Whereas I've seen the same friends pick up my Rockbox iPod and start songs just as easily as they would on their iPod. So it's like, I think the potential to get lost on both is probably equal, and the potential to not get lost is probably equal on both. So I'm just not clear on whether I agree with the fact that Rockbox isn't super easy, unless you're just saying that you want no options, which I could sort of agree with that. I mean, like, if you wanted a really, really basic interface, like a simple version of the interface, someone could probably design that. But as Doru points out, no one's bothering to do that. So we all have the advanced Rockbox interface, and that's that. Yeah, so that's Doru's email. We both emailed back and forth a few times, rather long emails, so I'm not going to keep going, but I could. It was a good conversation. But there is a little tiny bug that I found, and I haven't filed this yet with Rockbox, because it's not really a bug in Rockbox. It's actually a bug with Sansa. So I'm not sure who to tell exactly, but I'm going to mention it here and keep thinking about it. And if you have any ideas of who the best people to tell would be or anything like that, then email me and let me know. I might mention this to Doru, actually, because he might know. But anyway, so I was doing, I had Rockbox on since episode 14, and what I did was I was dumping music on there for an upcoming trip, and I loaded it up. I mean, there was not even a megabyte left on this machine, on this little Rockbox, and it worked fine. It played and worked beautifully, no problems. I was in heaven. I had every moment of my life was accompanied to me with music from this Rockbox device. It was great. So then I get back and to my main computer and I plug it in, and of course that triggers the original Sansa firmware, and everything's fine. I swap out a couple of songs, whatever. I unplug it and Sansa panics. It absolutely freaks out. Apparently, when you do not leave, I think the magic number was 90 megabytes. But if you don't leave 90 megabytes free on the internal memory card, then Sansa, whenever you are in the original firmware, and if you unplug and you are still in the original firmware, basically, if it ever gets to the point where it's trying to index, then it can't make a new index. It doesn't have any space. It's kind of like almost when a server runs out of space for log files, you know, it just panics. It doesn't know what to do with all this information. The disk was full, and Sansa, the original firmware, wants to make an index. That was one of my original complaints, remember? I don't want it to make an index. I couldn't care less about an index of my metadata. I don't care. I'm going to play the actual files. However, it does want to do that, and since this is version 2 of Fuse, there's no USB support within Rockbox. Every time you plug it into USB, it turns back into a Sansa fuse firmware device. And so when you unplug it and it starts indexing and it doesn't see anything on its drive to actually where it can actually store the index, then it looked to me like I had literally bricked the fuse. Like I really thought that it was, I mean, and it was weird to me because, I mean, it had played an entire, I mean, it was like days of music, you know, I mean, just it played fine, and it wasn't until I needed to either, I don't know, maybe I was recharging it or maybe I was dumping new music onto it, I don't remember exactly what, but the moment I unplugged it, it panicked and died and would not come back on. I still can't explain why it wouldn't come on. I don't know what that was all about. I wrote it off. I threw it on a shelf, kind of forgot about it for about 2 days while I kind of mentally dealt with the fact that I'd bricked a fuse. And then for whatever reason, I decided to try it again. So I took it and I popped it open, actually, just to kind of look at the inside because I thought it was dead anyway. It looks pretty interesting in there. Put it back together and then plugged it into my computer. I do know that I tried it on a lot of different computers with a lot of different kinds of USB ports, just trying to get the thing to be recognized. For whatever reason, on one of these systems, it came alive again. And for some reason, and again, I really don't know what sort of indicated to me that I needed to do this, but I took the music. I took about 90 megabytes of music off of the device, unplugged it. And sure enough, it refreshed its little index, it refreshed the media, made the index, and it's been working ever since. So, word of warning, on the internal SD card of the fuse, at least the version 2, you want to make sure that you've got at least 90 megabytes of free space for it, for the original firmware to take over and use for its malicious indexing of your data. Rex DeGier from AcrossAd, which is, of course, it's that site. He's got an Ogcast out, and it's also kind of a community site, I guess. And right now, he's created a forum with, I think it's PHPBB, and so you can go over there if you're looking for a forum to populate. Then acrossad.org might be a place to go to. I'm not really into the forum scene. I never really have been. I find forums usually not very helpful, and it's more like a kind of like water cooler discussion. You know, you just kind of like chat about stuff, but it's not real time. So, you know, it's just something else to check. So I'm not really huge into them, unless it's like Linux questions, which, you know, is always very helpful. Nevertheless, I think that an active forum is sort of an interesting and good thing to have. I mean, I like them conceptually. So possibly if you go to acrossad.org and kind of start posting, you never really know what you might learn. One of the questions that's been going through my mind lately is X apps. Like, what are some good, like really good X apps? Like, if you wanted to set up a computer with no GNOME, no KDE libraries, and you just wanted to run, but you still wanted to run X, right? So you just wanted to run X, but you wanted to do everything that you normally do, at least to a point, obviously, then what would be some of those killer apps be? Not necessarily like lightweight apps. It doesn't have to be super lightweight, although I guess X apps usually are, but they need to be X. You know, they can depend on TCL, they can depend on Fastlight Toolkit, FLTK, they can depend on all those things, but just not GTK or Qt. Really quite arbitrary, but that's just something I've been thinking about lately. And I did post in the Linux Link Tech Show forum, but for a while I wasn't getting any responses. I haven't checked back lately. Again, I don't really like forums that much, but it would be an interesting topic to discuss, I think. But anyway, yeah, so a new forum, acrossad.org, check that out. And check his Ogcast out if you don't listen to it. It's pretty darn good. And that's about it, I think. That's all the email I got from people, so hopefully some of that was interesting. And talk to you next time. This has been badapples.info, GNU, Linux, Og, and SpeaksCast. I'm Klaatu, and you can find me lots of different places. You can email me at klaatu@hackerpublicradio.org. You can also find me on IRC, irc.freenode.net, usually in the channel Ogcast Planet, because that's kind of the big collective of all the different Ogcasts. I'm also quite frequently in Slackware, Slacker Media for support, and random other channels, just depending on how I feel that day. I'm also on Jabber, jabber.org, as NotClad2. My nick on IRC, by the way, is NotClad2 as well. So Jabber is NotClad2, and of course the website for this fine Ogcast is thebadapples.info. That is thebadapples.info. So thanks for listening, thanks for all the emails and stuff, and keep listening, keep emailing, and I will see you around online.
There
sold this food supplement to treat 42 diseases. It has nothing of